So I'm very excited to tell you more about dark matter and what we can get out of dark matter from stars. And this picture will make sense later, I promise. So the overarching goal is to actually obtain a local map of dark matter. And by local map, I mean the phase space distribution of the dark matter in the solar neighborhood. So this is actually very timely because it would not have been possible some time ago. The reason for it is because we've had quite a bit of developments in two major areas, simulations and observation. Start with simulations. So for quite some time now, we were able to simulate the universe in a box where we start with some large box, we have dark matter, we teach you about gravity, and you just let everything kind of develop. It leads to a lot of these concentrations where galaxies are actually going to form and a lot of these filaments, as all of you know. But a few years back, we were actually able to go far beyond just having dark matter only simulations to include the physics of the baryons. And in particular, we can actually now track the gas, and this is a map of the temperature of the gas, which is very interesting and important in star formation, but also we can actually track the properties of this gas, and in particular, the gas metallicity, as you can see here, which actually translates to the metallicity of the stars. Finally, we're able to actually zoom into galaxies that actually look like a Milky Way, so spiral disk-like galaxies, and we can zoom in with very, very high resolution and actually study these galaxies. And this is pretty incredible. On the other hand, Gaia-DR2, which is a space telescope, actually released in 2018, a map of the proper motions and parallaxes of 1 billion stars. 1 billion stars, that's 1% of the Milky Way. And right now, I'm just showing you the movement of a mere 96 million stars and how they actually move over the next 800,000 years. So the developments in these two areas actually make it very timely to be able to use high-resolution simulations to track the dark matter and understand the physics of the dark matter and how it can correlate with that of the stars. And then we use Gaia data to actually end up with a local map of dark matter. So before I actually tell you what the dark matter is doing, let's kind of rewind and figure out how we thought about the dark matter map beforehand. So basically, we live in a galaxy that sits on a dark matter halo, as all of you know. So the sun is at about 8 kiloparsecs. So we live pretty close to the edge of the galaxy, which is a 10. We are part of a thin disk that rotates at about 220 kilometers a second. And again, we live in a halo that extends about an order of magnitude larger. If we were to take a look at the dark matter velocity distribution at the solar location, it has long been assumed that it is a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution from these early works. And this Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution that peaks at, again, about 220 kilometers a second, actually has a reason for existing the way it is. And I would like to actually kind of rewind and understand where this is coming from. So prior to the 1970s, we thought that we lived in a galaxy that looks like this, where basically you can see that the edges are actually rotating a lot slower than the center of the galaxy. With the work of Vera Rubin and collaborators in the 1970s, we found out that our Milky Way looks a lot more like this, where you can see here, I know they look the same, but basically if you look at the edges, you can see that now the edges are actually rotating almost as fast as the center of the galaxies. So these are basically the flat rotation curves, where on the x-axis here, I have the distance from the center of the galaxy, and on the y-axis, I have the rotational velocity. So if you actually thought that all the mass came from the visible mass, you actually expect the rotation curve to actually drop as a function of the radius. But what we found out is that it actually is flat. So if you were a physicist in the 1970s faced with this problem, you had about two ways to go. You can either change the laws of gravity, and some people have done that, or you go for option B, where you change the potential in which your system is actually living in. This is the standard halo model. And the simplest potential, gravitational potential, that's going to give you a flat rotation curve is that of an isothermal sphere. So the standard halo model is this model where we have a circular velocity that is a constant, sigma here is a number, rho is 1 over r squared, and this is isotropic, there's no angular dependence whatsoever. And then the enclosed mass, which comes just from integrating rho, grows linearly with r. And the enclosed mass has nothing to do with anything. I just like showing it because it makes particle physicists very uncomfortable, because nothing should just grow linearly with r. Things have to have some cutoff. Something has to happen there. But if you kind of put your discomfort on the side for a bit, and you just Keep going, take this, apply Poisson's equation, you actually end up with the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. The problem here is that you made two very important key assumptions that actually lead you to the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. And in particular, you had to assume that the system is in equilibrium and the system is isotropic. And of course, the question is the Milky Way really in equilibrium and isotropic? And of course, the answer is no. Otherwise, I wouldn't be asking and making all this dramatic entrance out of this. So first, let's take a look at what the dark matter halo in simulations now looks like. It's going to look like this, where the colors here are actually by the dark matter density. So this is where the central halo is going to be, and there is a lot more structure than that black sphere that I drew earlier. Interestingly, a lot of the structure I'm going to call subhalos, and one of these guys I'm going to call dark subhalo. And the reason that I'm making a difference and distinction here is because if I overlaid the stellar density map, some of the subhalo structure has a stellar overdensity, but this one does not. And we're going to go back to this idea later. So here, what I'm trying to say here is that the dark matter halo has a lot more structure. But of course, you can argue, well, this is simulations. Who knows if the Milky Way actually does that? For that, we turn to the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and we look at the northern sky, and we find that there is a lot more structure than we thought it was before. So this is SDSS. You can see here that there is this overdensity of stars that we're going to call GD1. This is the Orphan Stream. This huge thing is Sagittarius, and this small thing here is Pal 5. So, as you might expect, stars don't just rearrange themselves to make these beautiful orbits in the sky. So I would like to show you how these three of these, GD1, Sagittarius, and Orphan, so then the Orphan Streams actually formed. So we start with, this is the Milky Way, and we start with three dwarf galaxies that just fall into the Milky Way potential. The fact that there is a gradient of gravity between the two sides of this galaxy here makes it that the stars are going to be stripped in slightly different ways, which is why we have these beautiful structures in the sky where you have the stars here in the leading arm and a trailing arm in the back, and they're tracing something very close to orbits in the sky during their mergers. So this definitely defines the isotropy and the equilibrium assumptions, but you can say, well, these are the stars. What we're talking about is the dark matter. How do we think the dark matter is doing? Well, these dwarfs here actually come surrounded with their own dark matter halos. And if you assume that dark matter is collisionless, just like the stars, and the dark matter and these stars actually have the same initial conditions, they fell in at the same time during the same mergers, you expect the dark matter to be doing something very similar. This breaks the isotropy and the isotropy assumption, first of all, but also it breaks the equilibrium assumption because these are very transient states. After a very long time, everything is going to equilibrate, and we're not going to see a lot of these structures in the sky. So these are very recent mergers. So basically, this is telling us that the Milky Way is not isotropic, and it's not in equilibrium. But how much of a difference does this make? Interestingly enough, I would like to point out that these are not just three random events that just happen. This is how galaxies form in general. Galaxies form hierarchically by swallowing other galaxies. So
what fraction of stars are in the streams?
Oh, of stars is actually very, very small, but it's a much larger fraction of the dark matter is accreted that way. And there is a bit of a mismatch that I will just discuss a bit later. So, yes?
Sorry, while you stop, was that movie to scale? So those streams are really outside of the disk?
Yes, that's right. Yes. These are not getting that close to the disk yet. They're pretty far. GD1 is about 10 kiloparsecs. Sagittarius is just huge, the bigger one, and it does like multiple laps that are much further than the disk of the Milky Way. And there were a lot of papers about whether or not it actually pierces through the disk or not, but yeah, we're not gonna get to that. So now the interesting thing, I'm not gonna say, well, okay, our isotropy and equilibrium assumptions, they break, but we're not gonna say, okay, thank you and good night. We're gonna try to figure out a better way to actually establish the velocity distribution in the local map of dark matter based on our observables. So for that, I have a three-step program where from simulations, I'm going to show you how I can correlate some of the dark matter with some of the stars. Some is very key here, which that's why I didn't write it down. So you don't hold it against me, but we'll discuss that later. And then once I tell you which stars are going to track which part of the dark matter, I'm going to go into the Gaia data, measure the phase space distribution of these stars, and finally put one and two together to end up with a phase space distribution that is empirical for the dark matter. And step three looks a lot harder than it is a lot harder than it looks. So let's start with these simulations first. I'll be basing a lot of my analysis today on FIRE. FIRE stands for feedback in realistic environment. And now I'm going to show you a video, a very, very quick video, of how we form a galaxy that looks very much like the Milky Way. What I would like to focus on is how many mergers actually happen. And this is one of our quietest galaxies, which is pretty fun. So at the end, we're very close to redshift zero. And we end up with the Milky Way looking like galaxy. But this happens quite quickly, or purposefully I sped up that movie. So I would like to break it down into the different merging stages, just so I explain which, sorry.
So just cycles.
Oh, so just so I explain the different vocabulary that I'm going to use today. And I end up speaking very quickly, so please stop me. Also, I'm sleep deprived, so I'm just gonna run right through it. Okay, so first of all, we have a merging galaxy. So this is the object as it falls into the Milky Way. The stars at the bottom of the dark matter potential. Then we have a stage of a stream. This is just like the videos that I showed earlier, where the dark matter and you expect also the stars and you expectedly the dark matter are going to be stripped by the gravitational potential of the Milky Way. Third, there is a very important stage that is not as known in the literature, and it's that of a debris flow. So debris flow, I'd like to think of it as just like a long distance run, where everybody starts in one line, but after some time, you don't really see that line anymore, because somebody is ahead a lap, somebody is behind a lap, and then all you see is just like a clump of people who are moving at pretty much the same velocity with some velocity dispersion. So this is the same thing with stars. After quite a few orbits of streams, you don't really know which star is ahead in orbit and which one is behind, so it just looks like a clump of stars, but they still have some velocity substructure, even though you cannot see the spatial substructure anymore. And this is going to be interesting in what I'm going to tell you later. So what I'm going to do is that I'm going to take my simulations. This is my simulated Milky Way. And I'm going to look at this donut around what I expect the sun to be. Remember I said the sun is at about 8 kiloparsecs, so I'm going to look between 6 and 10 kiloparsecs in my simulations at the disk where I'm looking at vertical distances less than 1.5 kiloparsecs on both sides. And now I'm actually going to look at the dark matter and the stars that actually came in from mergers, and they land in this specific donut. Of course, because it's a simulation, I can cheat and I can figure out which dark matter came from which merger, which stars came with it, and what they're doing up to redshift zero. So we're gonna start with a very, very boring case, where what I'm showing you here is a histogram of the velocities today of the particles in this donut here of dark matter and stars that actually came in prior to redshift 3. So very, very old stuff. This here, I have a histogram in galactocentric spherical coordinates, so VR, V theta, and V phi here, where stars are in red and dark matter is in black. Yes? Oh, just because I wanted to look at the dark matter and the stars near the location of the sun in my simulation.
But then you showed us that the streams were actually.
So, what I'm interested in, that's a good question. So what I'm interested in is actually the local velocity distribution of the dark matter very close to the solar position. The streams were just an example to show you, like these are the most gorgeous examples of how anisotropy, the isotropy and equilibrium assumptions are actually broken. Yes, these three streams that I showed earlier do not have an effect on the local map, but other merging objects will, that I will discuss in a bit.
I guess maybe this is an assumption you're interested in this because of the dark matter detection experiment.
That's right, which I will get to in a little bit. Yeah, absolutely. So basically, we want to understand what the dark matter is doing in the solar neighborhood, because that's where our detection experiments are. Okay, so now for all the stuff that has merged prior to Redshift 3, so about 10 billion years ago, we can see here that the dark matter and the stars do follow each other. And that's very reassuring. But also, interestingly enough, these are actually three Gaussians with more or less the same dispersion, which means that if you put them together, you will end up with something very close to the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution assumption. And this makes sense because these mergers happened so long ago that they had indeed time to equilibrate, and that's why they're in equilibrium, isotropic, more or less than Maxwell-Boltzmann. But this is just a boring case. Let's look at a much more recent merger. So this is a merger that has happened at about redshift 0.9. And you see here that the dark matter, again, Vr, V theta, and V phi, dark matter and the stars are actually following each other. These are the dark matter and stars coming from one particular merger, redshift 0.9. But you can see that there is actually quite a bit of an interesting structure, especially in the radial velocities, which is why I'm going to focus on it. And in particular, there is this double peak structure here in VR. And the reason for it is that you can imagine if you have a sphere and you're shooting kind of an arrow through it that does a 180 and comes back, as the arrow kind of goes in, you have a peak in negative velocities. As it comes out, you have a peak of positive VR. So basically, these are signatures of very specific type of orbits and very specific, extremely eccentric type of mergers. Basically, mergers that actually have more circular orbits, for example, are not going to look like this at all. So again, you might not care, because after all, this is just a merger in a simulation. But it gets interesting when you see the same thing in data. So keep that in mind.
This is happening, you're saying, because you're focusing again on the solar neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
whereas most of the recently accreted stuff has orbits that are much larger than the solar radius.
So this, this happens just because this type of merger happen to have very eccentric orbits. So this depends basically on the impact parameter of this particular merger, how it fell in.
Yes.
To reach us, it has to have a smaller. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes. Because I'm focusing on the smaller, on the. So, that's right. Yes, that's right.
But I guess the question is, how many simulations did you have to get one of
these? So I looked at two simulations, each one, and I looked at the four most major mergers of each, and I think two or three had like these eccentric orbits. Some of them were a little bit slightly different structure, but the interesting thing is that the correlation is still there, regardless, that's the most important part. So I would like to show you a video of this merger, just because I really got into videos. So this is what the stars are, this is the dark matter. This mesh here is just like to show you, the donut that we're starting with is basically like my selection function. We're gonna start at redshift 0, and I'm gonna rewind the particles backwards in time. So, and this is where the sun is supposed to be. So at first, the particles are all over the place, and this means that it is indeed a case of a debris flow, it's not a stream, but as we move backwards in time, we actually will start seeing the spatial structure and then the merging object. And usually this is my water break. And you can see that we're almost there. You start seeing some spatial structure, everything kind of falling back, and that's a merging object where these are the stars and the dark matter came in together. So now the important question is, what does the Milky Way really look like? Here, what all I've done so far is that I told you which stars came in with which mergers. This is not something that we can do in data, at least it's not obvious, because stars do not come in with a label. So what we want to do is actually figure out what is the next proxy to be able to identify these stars. So just to kind of a bit of a review to figure out which stars I'm looking at, this is where we live. This is the disk of the Milky Way, which is made out of very, very young stars. The sun is a very, very young star. And these stars actually have nothing to do with dark matter whatsoever, which is why I don't care about them at all. The reason for it is because these stars are born out of the gas of the Milky Way. So they trace like the original initial conditions of that gas. While the stars that I'm interested in are accreted stars, so stars that have come in through mergers. And these stars are going to be here in what we call the stellar halo. So a quick, a brief history of time, where we started with a Big Bang, everything was very, very hot. And then as the universe cooled, we start forming more and more bound states. So we start with putting quarks together into protons, proton electrons together into hydrogen. And at some point early in the universe, we had mainly hydrogen and helium. Out of this form the first stars, which are metal poor because metallicity in astronomy means anything beyond helium. So basically these stars didn't really have much beyond hydrogen and helium. At the end of their lives, they explode into supernovae, and then these high-temperature, high-pressure systems actually are a great place to form gas. To form gas that actually is enriched with elements further down the periodic table, from which we are born new stars that are more metal-rich. They have a lot more metallicity. So to quantify this metallicity, I'm going to use Fe over H. This is the iron fraction with respect to hydrogen. This is a logarithmic scale taken with respect to the sun. So Fe over H is 0, that's the sun. Minus 1 means the star has a tenth of the iron fraction of the sun, minus 2 is 1/100, etc. And we can really use the metallicity as a proxy for age. So if we were to take a look at the chemodynamics of these stars, here I'm going to tell you that the disk stars and the accreted stars are actually in two different separate spaces. So if we take a look here on the x-axis, I have the vertical distance above the midplane. And on the y-axis here, I have this metallicity. So disk stars are pretty much, by definition, confined to the disk here from 0 to about 3 kiloparsecs. And they tend to be younger because they're actually getting born as they are. Well, they have gas and they're still getting born. So that's why some of them will be, you know, as young as the sun. Accreted stars, however, had to be born somewhere else and were brought in. And interestingly enough, in these mergers, because the gas is so collisional, the first thing that you do when you're actually pulling a galaxy into the Milky Way is that you're going to tidally disrupt the gas. Basically, you get rid of the gas. And that shuts off star formation. So all the stars had to be born somewhere else, and then they were brought into the Milky Way. And that's why they tend to be older, and they have lower metallicities. Also, because they're accreted stars, they have nothing to do with the disk whatsoever, so they're free to roam whatever vertical distances they want. You can imagine these accreted stars are just going this way. They're not really affected by the presence of the disk whatsoever. If we were to take a look at the rotational velocity, we find that the disk stars, again, at high metallicity, are going to be, almost by definition, co-rotating with the disk at about 200 kilometers a second, versus accreted stars that actually are the result of many, many mergers that come in from whatever which way. It averages out to 0 with a pretty high dispersion. So the metallicity actually also tells us about the original object that that has merged in. So here, for example, this is the mass-metallicity relation, where on the x-axis here, I have the stellar mass of a subhalo of a merging object, and on the y-axis here, I have the average metallicity of the stars. And this strong correlation here really tells you that basically if you wanted to form a larger object, you had to wait a bit longer, which means it has more younger stars, which pushes the average metallicity up. And we're going to go back to this mass-metallicity relation later. So now let's go into the Gaia data, now that we can actually tell at least where we expect the accreted stars to be, and measure their phase space distribution. So then the Gaia is awesome slide. Gaia is this space telescope that was launched in December 2013 of a goal of giving us the positional and kinematic measurements in slightly more technical language, parallax and proper motions of 1 billion stars. And that is 1% of the Milky Way. This is the largest kinematic catalog to date. It is pretty incredible. So here, I'd like to show this where this is the sun, this is the galactic center, so basically this is our galaxy, like this way, and this is the radius of the stars that Gaia, at the end of the mission, is going to have a parallax measurement for, distance measurement for, with an accuracy of 10%. This circle here is not just to tell you where the sun is, but that is the previous mission, Hipparchus, that ran from 89 to 93. And I made that comment one time, and somebody was like, you shouldn't be mean to Hipparchus. I'm like, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying we made quite a bit of an advancement in the field. But interestingly enough, out of Gaia DR2, the second data release of Gaia, which was actually which was available April 25th, 2018, so about a year and a half ago, it actually showed us that there is a lot more to the kinematic structures of the Milky Way than we thought. And in particular, we saw this merger, the Gaia Enceladus. So Enceladus is a Greek god, son of Gaia, properly named, and this is the most massive merger in the solar neighborhood. Let me show you a video of what it looks like. So this is the Gaia sausage. The Gaia Enceladus comes in. That's where the sun lived. And you can see it actually coming in and disrupting the Milky Way. And again, remember that the sun is here. So that's why we will be dominated by quite a bit of these Gaia Enceladus stars. But as I slipped and actually gave away the punchline. Unfortunately, the Gaia Enceladus is known by the name of the person that the person who first found him actually gave it, and it's a pretty terrible name, but stuck, which is the Gaia sausage. I know. So the Gaia sausage is a galaxy that has a mass about 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 9 solar masses. This is a stellar mass, so 1 to 10% of the Milky Way when it first merged in, and it fell in about 10 billion years ago, somewhere between redshift 1 and 3. And it is really interesting that we have such a huge, massive merger that we just found out about last year. But what I ended up doing is actually do the first kinematic modeling of this merger. So to do so, now we move to data. So I took the Gaia data, and I wanted to actually model the kinematic distribution of the Gaia sausage and all the different components. But unfortunately, only 1% of the stars at the solar location are actually accreted. 99% of the stars are disk stars, which have nothing to do with dark matter, so I don't care. You do the easiest thing first, which is you mask the disk and model above and below, and I will address this caveat a little bit later. So if I took the Gaia DR2 data, cross-matched with the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and the reason for that cross-match is just so I end up with metallicity information, which Gaia does not give me, I basically did a Gaussian mixture model to look at all the different components and their fraction. And I fit for, again, VR, V-theta, V-phi, and the metallicity all at once. So these are 3D Gaussians here with their proper correlations and everything, as well as their metallicity. So I'll go through all the different components and show you that they are indeed behaving as expected. So we start with the disk here in green, where nothing special here in VR, nothing in V theta, but it has a non-trivial azimuthal rotation. That's why you expect the disk to be. Also, we have a metallicity of minus 0.7. It's pretty high metallicity. Again, this is what we think, this is what we expect from the disk because these are younger stars. It's not higher than this just because, again, I'm masking 2.5 kiloparsecs. So this is the edges of the disk. Yes.
So is the idea is you just fit four Gaussians to the data? Is that, how do you know what is a disk and what is, I guess, halo and etc.?
Yes. So here, the interesting thing is that, yeah, I'm fitting basically a bunch of Gaussians. And interestingly enough, the first time we did this, I didn't have the metallicity information. And then I was just like fitting a bunch of Gaussians. And the fit was having like basically a hard time because, you know, a bunch of Gaussians. But then once I included the metallicity information and made sure that, you know, this same Gaussian here is matched with the ones, everything kind of like the fit figured out exactly what's supposed to happen. That was very beautifully converged.
And then you assume some priors on the properties of the Gaussian?
Yes, but I made sure that everything was very, very wide priors. So for example, like the disk, I did not make it like that the mean had to be between like 150. No, it was like, I think, minus 400 to 400 to all
about
of them.
The halo, do you assume the mean is zero?
No, I have like basically the mean and the dispersions. So the mean is minus 400 to 400, I think, and the prior and the dispersions are actually pretty large as well, like 600. It could be anything, and that's why it was very interesting once we included the metallicity information that everything kind of fell into place.
So the blue curve on the top left, it looks like it's double peaked.
Yes, that's right. So I'll get to that in 2 seconds. Okay, So the disk is behaving as expected. The rotation, yeah, again, is peaking at about 180 and it's not 220. And the reason for it, again, is because we're a bit higher above the disk. And interestingly enough, as I discovered, my journey in galactic dynamics is that the disk actually rotates slower the further you go. Okay, so then the component that I'm associating with the halo actually has the means in VR, V theta, and V phi about zero, with a very similar dispersion, actually, all of them. And it corresponds to a metallicity of minus 1.8. So it's a pretty older population. And this is what I'm calling halo, is basically the goes back to the simulation to, you know, the relaxed or virialized component, so the older component. The substructure here I actually modeled as two Gaussians in VR with a plus or minus sign, where basically the means are opposite signs, so it can actually kind of go this way. Interestingly enough, the first time I was doing this exercise, I did not know about the Gaia sausage, so I was trying to do like one Gaussian or two Gaussians, and nothing kind of was making any sense. Then I saw the paper with that structure, and we thought that, okay, let's do it as a double peaked, and in my head I was like, this will never work, but somehow it did. So I'm glad I was wrong in that one. So interestingly enough, this double peak structure here doesn't have any net rotation V theta and V phi, and it corresponds to a metallicity minus 1.4. So basically, this is an older population than the disk, but it's still younger than the halo. Interestingly enough, this is, I know I'm calling it substructure, but it's not really that much of a substructure because it corresponds to 60% of non-disk stars. So it really dominates over the halo component in the solar neighborhood. And this is pretty interesting because basically a lot of our stars, a lot of our accreted stars in the local neighborhood come from this merger.
Sorry, yeah. But I mean, are we reading too much into this? I mean, you have some distribution, you try to fit it with a bunch of kind of, I guess, principal components, just a bunch of functions.
And, yes.
I mean, if you add enough parameters, you can fit anything. Then is that really a detection of something or just?
So we know, this is not actually to argue for the detection of this merger, because this is not the original paper for the discovery of the merger. Interestingly enough, so for example, what we did here after the fact was to look at the residual and make sure that there is no, you know, no obvious structure that was left behind. And I'm working on something completely orthogonal when I'm just modeling the tail of the velocity distribution of the dark matter of the stars, and it actually picks up this component in a slightly different functional form because I'm doing it as a power law just to look at the tail of the distribution, and it picks up the same function or the same component with a similar fraction within the error bars, and without a bunch of Gaussians or anything, with a completely different data set, for example, the one without the cross match with SPSS. So, yeah.
Let me ask a related question. So that's 60%.
Yeah.
60% plus minus, plus 40%, minus 60%?
That's a good question. I think it was, what was it? I think plus or minus 5 to 10. I have the plot at the end in the bonus slides. So I can show you that later. But yeah, so I think it was like between 50 and 70%.
And what's the main source of the uncertainty?
It's basically like when we fit for this, we also fit for the relative contributions and basically the posterior, we have like the full posterior of the distribution. So I think it is statistics that would be leading here, so it's not the error bars on the velocity measurement. I think it's statistics.
So the motions of the stars in this sausage are mainly in the plane of the disk, it looks like, in the radial direction.
That's right.
That's surprising. I mean, like your movies that you were showing, the satellites coming in were just like randomly.
Right. Yes. So this is a little bit, so First of all, we actually have like the two populations, right? The stuff that is coming in and the stuff that is coming out. In the video of the Gaia saucers that I showed, this particular merger really kind of overwhelms over like the solar neighborhood and over like quite a bit of the disk. So it's not, I wouldn't say that it comes like right within the disk, it's just because it extends so much further than, actually, hold on. It's basically like, if this is the Milky Way, this is the galactic center, this is the sun, and the Gaia sausage is about like, it's a bunch of stars are like this. So I wouldn't say that it is like really within, this is just like the subset that is here of these stars that I'm looking at that end up with a lot of radial velocities. But like also, this is radial and spherical coordinates out of this center. So it's just like some of them are doing this and some of them are doing this. The reason that I'm arguing for this is because there will be another merger at the end that is really within the disk that I will discuss in a bit. That's right. So stuff that is just like coming in and out like this. Yeah. Or some of them are actually coming in and turning like somewhere there and then coming out this way. Yeah.
Does that happen? I mean, in simulations, that you get like a round distribution with a non-isotropic velocity.
It depends really on like the initial conditions of the merger, of the initial merger, right? Like how it fell into the Milky Way. And that really affects like the dynamics afterwards. Yeah. And I think the impact parameter of the sausage itself was actually pretty small. So it was kind of like its initial conditions fell in pretty close to the disk as is. And that's why it ends up with very eccentric orbits. Yeah. Versus something that if it was falling in like this, it will end up with, more largely circular orbits. Yeah.
So it was unusual to fall in so directly toward our. If you don't, then you're not going to see it.
Yeah, there is a bit of a selection there because we're only looking very close to the sun, right?
If it's not falling regularly, then we're not going to see it. It's going to be an average of Milky Way. Sure, but of the stars that are local, you can see that the anisotropy is quite extreme, right?
Yes, that's true.
For this component.
I think my next slide is, this is the velocity anisotropy that I showed from the simulated one, and I only looked at two simulations and like a few mergers, and it actually does show up, and this is the one in data, so.
This is everything or just that component?
Just that component, yeah. So here what I'm arguing for is that in simulations, we actually saw a component that has this double peak structure, and the stars and the dark matter follow each other, and then in data, we actually picked up a component that does a similar thing. So now the question is, how can we get the dark matter here?
And the velocity anisotropy for this component is similar to what you showed for the sausage.
That's right, but then again, I did not use any information out of the simulation. This is just like an example that does look similar, but when I was fitting, for example, I did not really expect I did not put in any priors just based on this simulation. That's what I want to make clear. Okay, we can discuss more later. Okay. So now let's actually try to understand what the dark matter is doing. So the dark matter speed distribution is going to have a component from this relaxed virialized component here, halo, and then a component from the substructure. However, because nothing comes easy, these mergers do not contribute the same amount of stars as they do dark matter. And the reason for it is because a lot of these galaxies have a different mass to light ratio. Some of them have a lot of stars and a bit more dark matter, and some of them are just like dominated by dark matter and have very, very little stars. Which means that I had to rescale the fraction, that 60% fraction from earlier, to figure out how much dark matter such merger would have brought in. And to do so, I actually used the mass metal issue relation from earlier, because that tells me how much like the stellar mass of the object, as well as abundance matching, which is an empirical relation that tells me about how much About the mass of the halo that lives in such a mass of the galaxy. It has quite a bit of spread, which is why the component of the substructure here, or the Gaia sausage, after I convolve all of these errors, I end up with about 42% with pretty large error bars, plus 20, sort of minus 22, so quite a range here. And then, this is the speed distribution that I end up with. So now I'm not looking into component, I'm just looking at the speed. And the substructure, or the sausage here, is in blue, the halo is in red. You put them together and you end up with this. This is normalized to one, that's why the error bar is a bit smaller than you would have expected otherwise. And this here in dashed gray is the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, or this the standard halo model from earlier. So you can see here that it actually peaks at a lower values. But there are two very large caveats to what I'm saying here. So this is not the end of the story, and this is not the full dark matter velocity distribution. And the two important caveats here, one, and that I mentioned earlier, the fact that I masked 2.5 kiloparsecs off the disk, which means that this is actually, okay, this translates to the velocity distribution high up, but does it actually go all the way in to z equals zero? And I will address this in a second. But there is another second major caveat that goes back to all of these stories from earlier, which is the dark subhalos. This holds only for mergers that have stars in them. And as I said earlier, there are halos that do not have any stars, which means that they would not be able to be tracked this way. And what I have to do next is actually estimate the fraction of disrupted dark subhalos and how many of them there are and what is their velocity distribution. You can imagine a world where all the dark subhalos, for example, have like a peak velocity like here that we need to correct for. Or all of them are much, much slower. And it is something that I really need to account. So this is with respect to this is what we call like the dark matter distribution from the luminous satellites. Yeah. So there is a luminous fraction, and then there is the dark fraction that we need to add. Yes. So this is with respect. So one here is just the luminous fraction. Yes. Okay. All right, so since I'm not going to discuss the contribution of the dark subhalos, I will go back into trying to understand what happens as z equals zero. But before then, I'm going to tell you why you should care about this, which is implications for direct detection. So direct detection, we have a xenon atom there. The dark matter, properly colored, comes in, and they scatter off each other, and actually we have some scintillation light that we detect, and this is how a lot of direct detection experiments work. So this is actually a video from the Lux experiment. However, the amount of scintillation light that comes in actually does depend on the properties of the dark matter. And in particular, it depends on the dark matter velocity. And you can think of it as basically like if the dark matter is very, very energetic, it's going to deposit a lot more energy into the xenon, and we're going to see it a lot easier. However, plots like this, which you've seen them multiple times, have already the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution already in them. So here on the x-axis, I have the dark matter mass. On the y-axis, I have dark matter nucleon scattering cross-section. And this black line here is the xenon one-ton limit. But this line already has baked in it the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. And unlike the density distribution, which is like an overall factor of up and down, it does actually change the shape. So, for example, again, this is the same plot, but I remade it. So if we were to assume the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, it would be this dashed gray line. But if I was to assume, for example, the distribution that I showed you earlier, which again, by no means is the last dark matter distribution that you will ever see, at least for me, then you will see that we actually, that it affects the lighter dark matter a lot more than the heavier one. And this is because you're more sensitive to the tail of the velocity distribution in the lighter mass. And unfortunately, you might end up in scenarios where you're actually over-constraining and ruling out more parameter space than you should be, which is why it is very important to actually get this straight. So let's actually now go dig in a little bit more into this accreted star component that is actually closer to the plane. So as I said, 1% of the stars close to the disk plane are accreted. which means it's really a needle in a haystack situation. So once you're facing that problem, you can just, you know, make a computer do it. So this is my machine learning slide, where we train a neural net to figure out what these accreta stars look like. So basically, neural net, you teach it what a cat is, you teach it what a dog is, and then you ask it, is this a cat or a dog? Which at first I actually couldn't tell, so I had to wait till the end of the video to figure out that it was a dog in the laundry basket. Now we have to do something very similar. So basically I have I use a simulation of the Milky Way and a mock Gaia catalog built on that simulation. So basically this is what would Gaia see if I lived in a galaxy that was my simulation. And then I teach it the difference between an accreta star and a disk star, and then ask the computer to do this for me. So far I haven't fooled anyone. One of them is real. And I had to pick a very bad Gaia picture. And one of them is a simulation. So who says the first one is a simulation?
The top one?
Yeah. Anyone who says the bottom one is a simulation? No, see? Well, yeah, it's true. And my guess, was it the Large Magellanic Clouds that tipped you off?
Yeah, I showed this picture before. The bottom.
Oh, I showed it rotated. That's good. Okay. The structure here, yeah. Yeah. Sorry?
Marianne,
oh, she stole it from me. Okay, no, I'm kidding. Okay, so yeah, the last suggestion that I heard is that somebody told me to show two pictures of the simulation just to trick everybody, but I have not done that yet. Okay, so basically we train on the simulation what an accreta star looks like, and then we label the Gaia stars. However, we're not really training on pictures anymore. We're training on the two positions in the sky, L, B, and the parallax, as well as the two proper motions. And of course, we have to resample a few times to take into account errors. One important thing that we have to do is actually make sure that we're not overtraining our neural net to pick out structures that just look like the simulation. And in particular, we retrain the last layer. This is called transfer learning, and basically to teach it what Gaia itself looks like, so it doesn't just spits out everything that it just looks like the simulation. And I'm happy to discuss this a little bit more later. Okay, so now what I can do, so this was work in collaboration with Brian Ostick, who is now at Harvard. And Brian did this amazing work with a neural net and actually gave me basically the catalog of the stars very close to the sun. And he was like, these are your stars, have fun. I was like, awesome, let's do this. So the first thing you do is actually plot your stars. Now I'm plotting over densities in VR, VPhi, VR, VTheta, and VTheta and VPhi. So if my neural net was was actually behaving as expected, there is one accreted structure that has to be in my accreted catalog. What is that structure?
Sausage.
Thank you, the sausage, the horribly named one. So indeed, you can actually even see it by eye, right? Like that there is this VR here with not much VPhi, this density is here, and then you can actually throw in a clustering algorithm, and the guy in Enceladus is here. It's actually, I had to put it with two different Gaussians, but put them together because I knew that they should be together. And there is the halo, again, as expected. Interestingly enough, there is this structure over here. And then the question is, what was this? And at first, for the longest time, I thought that I had a bug, so I didn't tell anyone. But trying to look at the literature, and there's nothing about this structure. So I was like, well, okay, if I find it, I get to name it. So this structure I'm calling Nyx, Nyx for the Greek goddess of the night. So if I were to look at the stars from Nyx, this is what they look like. So this is X and Y in position space, X, Z, Y, and Z. The sun here is this little star, and this little arrow is basically the motion of the sun. So basically here I found 503 stars with high likelihood to belong to that Gaussian, and they all have this coherent motion of all of them going together. So let's actually focus on this one, and I subsampled the star just so I can see better what's going on here. So again, you can see that there is this large coherent motion. These stars have also have a prograde component, so they also co-rotate. The gray stars in the back are actually what the disk is. So this is the sun. The galactic center is about like here. So the stars, these disk stars are actually rotating this way around the galaxy. And the Nix stars are actually having, they have a co-rotating movement, but they also have a radial velocity. So in this fraction, the Nix stars are actually 13% of my sample. The sausage is about 72, which I'm not showing here. And then the halo is 15. So this structure, this new structure, Nix, actually has quite a bit a non-trivial fraction. So in order to understand what it is, we kind of go back and put in a Milky Way potential. This is where the sun is, and then I kind of rewind 1 giga-year. And you can actually see it a bit co-rotating with the disk and actually see it coming in from a little bit above the disk. So what I think is happening, and it needs to, and I have quite a bit of things that I'm still working on to confirm, is that this is actually a merging event that actually merged in with in a fashion that is actually co-rotating with the disk, and then with dynamical friction kind of got stirred with the disk, and this is why it ends up ends up with this kind of co-rotating fashion. So if I reduce the purity of my sample in my neural net, I actually see that there is another structure on the other side. So this is Nix. This is Nix 2. This is in VR V5. So there is this other structure that has the same chemical properties, but it's going in the opposite direction. So these are the stars, the kind of Nix stars. And then you can think of the other one as actually a second passage of the same merging event. Interestingly enough, in one of our simulations, so what we did is actually rerun everything on the simulation. So basically train on a completely different galaxy, apply the neural net on this new simulation, and then apply the clustering algorithms and figure out what's going on. So in this is the simulation analog, I knew for a fact that there is a large stream here that actually gets into very close to the solar neighborhood of my simulation. And when I run all of the above, so basically the neural net and the clustering algorithm, I pick up two structures here, which actually are they're analogous to these two. And again, they actually go into two different directions. So basically go in this way, and then it's a different passage to go in this way. Interestingly enough, because this is a simulation, I can actually see what it looks like. And this is my galaxy, and that is that merger that got pulled in, and it's actually, and you can see some of it is actually prograde with the disk. So this is very, very interesting. And the reason for it is because such mergers could actually lead to the presence of an accreted dark disk, because if they bring in their own dark matter in, it's going to actually come into the dark disk. And it's very important to figure out how much of that contribution is. However, only a small subset of these stars actually have their chemical abundances. So what I did is actually I submitted my first telescope proposal to figure out, to study the chemical abundances of these stars, which is very interesting. And then the second thing that I have to do is actually correlate the dark matter and the stars in stream. So what I said earlier is that the dark matter and stars actually are very well correlated in the cases of old mergers, and in the cases of debris flow. I didn't say anything about streams. And the reason for it is because the stars fall at the bottom of the potential well of the stream, and once they start getting stripped, there is still a bit of a phase difference between the stars that are all the way into the potential well and the dark matter that extends a little bit further. When you get to the debris flow stage, you already got rid of all the dark matter that is on the outside, and you're stripping kind of the stars and the dark matter on the inner part. So that is something that we have to do. And then we need to estimate how much dark matter really got brought in with Nix once we establish whether or not it is indeed a merger. But of course, the story doesn't end here. Gaia DR3 is coming in online. So we're going to have improved astrometry, so better error bars in 2020. And we're going to end up with radial velocities of a much, much larger set of stars, about 100 million, which is pretty incredible. There are a lot of other telescopes are going to be online. LSST, starting in 2023, is going to give us the proper motions of a much fainter set of stars. So it's going to go beyond the Gaia data set into fainter stars. And then MSC, which is hopefully going to start in 2029, is going to give us the radio velocity measurements of the stars with errors down to 100 meters a second. These stars are going about 100 kilometers a second. So this is pretty incredible. So what to conclude, what I told you today is basically that from simulations, we can correlate the dark matter and the stars from the very old mergers, as well as from the debris flow. And what we want to do is actually build the empirical local velocity distribution of dark matter component by component, starting with these. And then we go into the Gaia dataset, measure the phase space distribution of these stars, properly rescale them, to end up with a local phase-space distribution. But I would like to end with my biggest discovery of all, which is my talent for Photoshop, because this is Nyx coming out of the Milky Way. Thank you. Nyx is the Greek goddess of the night, by the way. So, yeah. That's true, but it's the only picture that I had to kind of play with, but yeah. But then again, we never have really a picture of the Milky Way. You can go ahead. Okay. Yes. Yes. Yeah. So basically applying Jean's equation kind of leads to the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution from the beginning in that whole reasoning. And although Jean's equation, the full Jean's equation holds with the time-dependent part, holds for non-equilibrium situations, we don't usually know the time-variant part, which we set to zero, which means that if you're in a merger and non-equilibrium situation, Jean's equation will be very hard to actually kind of apply and make sure that it's valid. So that's why we don't really use it here. We try to kind of get everything very empirical and not kind of go back into...
In the simulations.
Yes. Yeah. That has been mainly fixed with the presence of baryons. So once you include the baryons, you don't really have much of a cusp anymore. Yeah. And that fixes the feedback.
So looking forward, right now you have to extract a dark matter subcomponent distribution by looking for tracer stars.
Yeah.
And at their velocities. Do you see any prospects for validating that correlation between the tracer stars and the inferred subcomponent of dark matter by directly measuring like velocity distributions and just seeing the effect of that? And maybe it wouldn't occur like in the bulk of the Milky Way, but maybe you could use like a dwarf galaxy or something like that. Do you see any prospects for that?
So I think that it's a bit difficult because basically all you're given is really just the stars, and you're trying to kind of, if you had the stars and the gravitational potential, then you kind of can do something like that. Interestingly enough, what I'm thinking about though is that I'm currently looking at simulations of non-standard dark matter. So all of this holds for cold dark matter, right? So for example, if you had self-interacting dark matter or more dissipative models, I think, or at least I expect the mergers to look very different, especially because the dark matter is going to be very different, obviously, but then if that feeds back into the stars in such a way that we can use the kinematics of the stars to rule out some of the parameter space of the dark matter. So that's what I'm going to look at next. I'm not sure if it's going to be applicable with the cold dark matter. Yeah.
What kind of facility do you need to measure enough metallicities of these stars to be useful?
Oh, a very large survey would be great. And for Nyx stars, because I actually really want to kind of. So Nyx stars actually cross match them with Rave. Apogee. With Apogee, I found only 3 stars, which was pretty sad. With Rave, I got about like 80 with metallicity, but like 30 to get everything, to get like the magnesium, so alpha elements. So for these, I have a Keck proposal to go and measure actually at least a subset, you know, in a night where you just like stare at them. Having a very large area survey, I think, that goes a bit deeper than, or yeah, that covers a good chunk of the sky, both the northern and the southern hemisphere, that would be very ideal.
They're all over the sky.
So yeah, so actually I think I have it here. Yep. Yeah, and the reason for it is because, yeah, if you remember earlier, there were just, you know, a bunch that were coming in on both on the bottom and on the top. So if you take a look at the map, they're just like all over the place. And this is in galactic coordinates, but yeah. But the reason for it is just because they're going right through it. Yeah. Sorry?
Desi ancillary
programming. Oh. Yes.
So I was confused by why there are so few of these. I mean, you did a bunch of cuts to end up with that distribution of the obvious place, I guess. Is that the reason? I mean, there are, I guess, a million stars or something with basis space information. So
there is there are 7 million. And then, and I think after you make some good parallax cut to get better distances, you end up with about 4 million. And as I said earlier, only about 1% of these stars are actually accreted. So you end up with about 40,000. Yeah.
Based on how do you know?
That's the result of the neural net, the neural network, the machine learning part. Yeah. And to actually figure out NICs, I wanted extreme purity, so that's why I actually kind of got the cut really, really high, and I was left with a total of about 7,000 stars. Yeah. But then you can kind of lower that at the expense of including some decontamination. Yeah, so basically it gives a score to each star, and then where do you put your cut is the situation. And because I was worried that it was some kind of discontamination or something funny, I looked only at the extremely pure and the extremely pure stars. Yeah. Yes.
So you had a slide where you had the fraction of stars that were in the halo, fraction that were in the sausage. And then 1% of the stars you said that fell in and get captured by the disk. What fraction of the stars that are kind of around us are just stars? And then that some of the ones that you divided into sausage?
So it's about 1%. So yeah, 1% of the stars are accreted, 99% are going to be disk stars that have nothing to do.
The stars that fell in, but if I look at the stars around us, is that also?
It's a, yes, or at least like. Yes. So I think from at least in simulations, it ends up being about 1%. And I think there is this review paper, well, not review paper, but there is this paper from SDSS in 2007 that kind of tracks the different metallicity components close to the sun. And it's, yeah, and it ends up about 1%. So something very small, very small component that is, So what I did, hold on, actually. Oh, here we go. This is the one. So this is from before. These are the different components, but this is before the neural net. So this is from last year, Gaia DR2 and Gaia DR2 and SDSS, and these are the different components. Like if you mask Z cuts of above 2.5, 3, 3.5, and 4. These are the error bars of the sausage component as a function of the non-disk stars. So sausage divided by sausage plus halo. And this is to answer somebody's question about the error bar on that fraction that was here. So you can see here, for example, that the disk component actually does keeps on decreasing like the further up you go. And then the sausage is more or less constant. And then the halo kind of increases to make up for the disk component. But yeah.
So once you have, when you have 100 million stars, you're expecting a million of them to be these.
That's right, which is quite an increase from. So this is about a factor. It's more than an order of magnitude increase in these stars. So it's going to be quite a lot. Mm-hmm. Yes.
The thickness of the galactic disk may provide the apparent diameter mass of the accreted galaxy, accreted subset galaxy. Is it consistent with
That's a good question. So I think the limit from the literature is how much. I remember we had to take a look at this. There is a limit about how many, like the number of, what was it? The number of accreted, the fraction of an accreted stars from a very large merger. But that was a very big caveat to that, that we didn't, that Nix, for example, we didn't go to. And I can't remember on top of my head what the caveat was, but we had to add that discussion to the paper. So I'll take a look and talk to you about it. Yeah. Thank you.